B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, October 5th, 2017. Got a lot of news to cover today. Big things happening in Washington and elsewhere. Our top story is that California Democratic Congresswoman Linda Sanchez, who is the fifth-ranking Democrat in the House leadership, has broken ranks, and she has also broken a taboo. She told a C-SPAN gathering with reporters from the Washington Post and Los Angeles Times that it is time for Nancy Pelosi and her generation to retire from Congress and pass the torch to a new generation. That was John F. Kennedy's phrase, some of you will recall. And Linda Sanchez, not a dangerous lefty. She's a fairly moderate member of the Democratic centrist group. She represents part of Orange County, which is not a liberal area. But she's shown herself to be a serious member, as contrasted with her sister, Loretta, who is kind of flighty and prone to bizarre statements in the media. And she ran for the Senate here in California last year, lost, and is now in retirement. But Linda has expressed what many of us have been saying for some time, including your humble host. I've known Nancy Pelosi since she went to Congress in 1987. I like her personally. I've told you before that I worked on one of her campaigns back in 1996 and got to know her better. But it is time for her to step down. Her leadership has run its course, and I believe that Linda Sanchez is expressing what many, if not most, Democrats believe. She told the Newsmakers show, "I do think it's time to pass a torch to a new generation of leaders. I want to be a part of that transition. I want to see that happen. I think we have too many great members here who don't always get the opportunities that they should, and I'd like to see that change." And pressed by reporters, she said that Steny Hoyer, the House Minority Whip from Maryland, and James Clyburn, the Assistant Minority Leader, should also prepare to step down. And she's not demanding that they leave immediately, but she thinks that the midterm elections in 2018 offer the perfect opportunity. And I agree with her. Now, Sanchez has been in Congress since 2003, so that's a little less than 15 years, and it puts her in a strong position, but she doesn't have the baggage of people like Pelosi and her pals who have been there for 30 years or longer. Another big story out of Washington, Trump has followed through on the threat that he announced or inferred in his speech at the UN General Assembly, and he says that he will formally announce next week that he is decertifying the international nuclear deal with Iran, saying that it is not in the national interest of the United States. But what he really means is that it's not in the interest of the state of Israel, and that's why he is taking these actions. Now, this is not really an option that is available. This is a six-nation deal. And the idea that the U.S. can unilaterally withdraw really is just a breach of the agreement that allows Iran to resume the enrichment of uranium and the nuclear weapons program that many of us believe is simply a sham that Iran uses to enhance its negotiating position with the U.S. and Israel. At any rate, this is a very dangerous move, and in the effort to corral North Korea, this sends a really stupid signal from Washington. And just in the last few days, the Defense Secretary Mattis, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Dunfer, they have both said that Iran is in compliance and they do not support a unilateral shift away from this agreement. So technically what happens is that Trump notifies Congress and then they have a period of time, I think it's 60 days, a 60-day congressional review period to consider next steps. So it's not necessarily definitive that Trump makes this announcement, but it does certainly complicate the situation and enhances the leverage that Iran has, which, again, is really a stupid move. Trump has this knack for elevating secondary or tertiary powers like Iran or North Korea to the level of the United States. Oh, it's really mind-boggling. I want to recommend Robert Perry's latest piece on Russiagate as he once again takes apart the exaggerated reporting of the New York Times and the Washington Post that stokes a lot of people's beliefs and the unproven allegations of Russian meddling in our election last year. And the latest wave, of course, has been about the Russia-linked ads on Facebook. And the more we learn about it, the less important, the less significant the disclosures of recent weeks become. And Perry does a good job of explaining that the $100,000 that we have heard was spent by Russia-linked entities on these ads. First of all, it's a drop in the bucket to Facebook. It's a drop in the bucket in terms of generating any serious number of impressions. It was a three-year period that the so-called 3,000 ads and the $100,000 covers. We know that 55% of the activity occurred after last November's election, and that the original report of up to 70 million impressions has been dialed down to 10 million impressions. And Perry goes on to note that the New York Times used a questionable source, Clinton Watts, the former FBI agent and what Perry describes as a top promoter of the new McCarthyism that has swept official Washington. Watts has been the source of information, for example, claiming that Marco Rubio's presidential campaign suffered from an online Russian campaign against him. And Bob Perry has the balls to point out that, hey, Marco Rubio flamed out on his own. He really didn't belong in the presidential primaries, and it didn't take Facebook ads. He could not even carry his own state of Florida, which was central to his claim that he could build a base to run for president. There is more in Bob Perry's piece. I've linked to it in the show file for today's podcast. Check it out. Now we turn to the politics of gun control following this massive, ugly massacre in Las Vegas earlier this week. And we're seeing that cynically and strategically, the NRA and its owned and operated members of Congress are deciding to throw America a bone. They're saying, well, you know, we'll talk about this idea of banning bump stocks. And these are the replacement stocks that permit a semi-automatic weapon to be fired in the fashion of an automatic weapon. And so we're seeing that the NRA, Wayne LaPierre, and key Republicans on the Hill are saying, oh, yeah, you know, that this makes sense. The NRA statement said they believe that devices designed to allow semi-automatic rifles to function like fully automatic rifles should be subject to additional regulations. But at the same time, they claim that they want to continue to press Congress to pass a law to make it easier for owners who have a concealed carry permit in their home state to travel to any other state in the union and continue to carry their weapon. This is their theory that a good guy with a gun is the antidote to a bad guy with a gun. And this is nonsensical. It will not pass muster politically. The states will block this. But that's the advocacy that we're getting. And to its credit, the New York Times today, in an opinion piece written by a few reporters, notes the ranking of members of Congress and the amount of campaign cash they have received from the NRA. And number one on the list is John McCain of Arizona. Number two, Richard Burr, the chair of the Intelligence Committee from North Carolina. Both of them gotten around $7 million over their careers from the NRA. And the Times also published the thoughtful comments, the compassionate, empathetic remarks, I guess empathic is the right word, uttered by these hypocritical politicians. And it's all about thoughts and prayers. You can find this at the New York Times. By the way, all of the top 10 recipients of NRA cash in both the Senate and House are Republicans. And when we look at polls indicating what the public considers to be reasonable gun regulation, 85% support barring sales to all violent criminals, 67% support an assault weapons ban, 62% a semiotic gun ban, 62% support a ban on high-capacity magazines, 89% support universal checks for gun buyers, 73% universal checks for ammunition buyers, 88% want to bar sales to people deemed dangerous because of their mental health. And what's interesting is that on this list, all of these proposals rank above 60% in popular support. The one that is not listed is the Democratic advance proposal from a couple of shooting sprees ago that we should bar people on the no-fly list from buying guns. And as I've pointed out, that is a very empty idea, because the no-fly list is so badly managed, so arbitrary, that it has no credibility. And this will, in fact, deny the right to buy a gun to people who are innocent and, you know, should otherwise not have any rights curtailed. I was stunned to see the byline of Bret Stephens under a headline of an op-ed piece in today's New York Times. Bret Stephens was recently recruited to the Times. He's a pretty conservative guy, and there was some backlash from liberal and progressive Times subscribers who said, what's this guy doing in our newspaper? Well, he surprised me, because the headline reads, Repeal the Second Amendment. Now, he makes some points that I don't fully agree with. He claims that the campaign cash of the NRA is not that important. It pales in comparison to the money that comes from other special interests. And that may be true, but the loyalty of Republicans to the NRA, with or without the campaign cash, is not subject to debate, in my opinion. Now, Stevens points out that there are some statistics that drive his argument to repeal the Second Amendment. For example, this self-described conservative points out that in the last year of statistics, 2015, there were a mere 268 justifiable homicides. That's a good guy with a gun taking out a bad guy with a gun. But there were 489 unintentional firearms deaths, and as many as 141 of those were children. And he goes on to deplore some of the way that liberals have tried to marshal support for various gun control proposals. But in his summation, he says, Americans who claim to be outraged by gun crimes should want to do something more than tinker at the margins of a legal regime that most of the developed world rightly considers nuts. They should want to change it fundamentally and permanently. There's only one way to do this. Repeal the Second Amendment. He says, take the guns, or at least the presumptive right to them, away. The true foundation of American exceptionalism should be our capacity for moral and constitutional renewal, not our instinct for self-destruction. Well, I have a new appreciation for Bret Stephens, and I agree with him. Is it politically achievable? I don't think there is a prayer of that happening. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Patrick Garay, Abby McMillan, Susan Lundgren, George Reeves, and Andrew Harnack. Thanks to each of you for your support, and that's when I invite others who aren't currently supporting me to change that. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click on menu, click on become a subscriber. It'll take you to the sign-up page, and our webmaster has finally cleaned up the mess I made with all of the bonus books there. There's now only one cover photo of each bonus book. So take a look, and if you take out a new annual subscription and give me a mailing address in the continental U.S., one of those bonus books can be on its way to you. A couple of details are emerging. As you know, yesterday I shared with you a series of questions that have been raised about the events in Las Vegas on Sunday night. Was there a second shooter? To me, that remains an open question, and I heard an eyewitness call into a radio show today, a woman who did escape injury herself but was next to a woman who took a bullet in the stomach. And she said, for example, listener George Mashke pointed out that eyewitness testimony can often be inaccurate. But what she said was that she heard two different types of rapid-fire gunshot sounds at the same time. Now, this is a crucial bit of testimony. I don't consider it conclusive, but it keeps open the question as to was there a second shooter? Because it's not really likely that Paddock, as has been described, and we've seen pictures of his dead body in his hotel suite, and there were two open windows or windows that he broke open that he could have fired from, but they were 20 or 30 feet apart. And it doesn't appear that he could have been firing two weapons at the same time. Now, I want to acknowledge that this is speculation, but I remain skeptical of the way the official narrative has been compressed and, the unruly details have been squeezed out. And one of the questions we asked yesterday got a partial answer. I asked about the note that was left inside the suite at the Mandalay Bay Casino. Now, Sheriff Lombardo of the Las Vegas County, Clark County. Let me correct myself. The sheriff runs the Metropolitan Police Department. That's a little different from most jurisdictions. So the sheriff said it was not a suicide note. I'm comfortable saying that. Well, why aren't you comfortable at least characterizing the note or reading the damn thing to the public or releasing it to the media? We also haven't seen honest answers about why it took 72 minutes for the police to actually enter the hotel suite on the 32nd floor. Consider the source of this, all right? I'm reporting this to you without endorsement. But the Drudge Report is linking to a report from PJ Media, which is I characterize as a Trump loyalist media platform, and they continue to present information from the Islamic State. We know that on Monday morning, the news agency Amaq claimed that the Las Vegas attacker is a soldier of the Islamic State. The FBI immediately dismissed that. That dismissal, because we don't trust the FBI, raises more questions and opens up the opportunity for the Islamic State to exploit this in an opportunistic manner. And the new issue of their online publication called Al-Naba has been released, and the Islamic State is claiming that Stephen Paddock converted to Islam 6 months ago, and they've claimed to have given him a nom de guerre, which is Abu Abdul Bar al-Amriki. And the statement says, the brother Abu Abdul Bar stationed himself for the invasion on the 32nd floor of a hotel overlooking a concert and killed a whole bunch of people. Now, I don't believe this, but because we cannot trust our government, because the FBI has lied to us so many times, because the FBI has framed so many Muslim Americans as so-called domestic terrorists, I report this for your consideration and to let you know that we have many unresolved issues about this really ugly event. The central government in Baghdad is claiming that Iraq has vanquished the Islamic State from virtually all Iraqi soil. They claim that near the border with Syria, there is an outpost in the city of Qaim, is that Qaim, that is still held by the Islamic State, but they have liberated the town of Hawija, and they are declaring victory. And this just leads to one big question. Okay, what's next? What happens in Iraq? Do the Kurds get to really become independent? And what happens in Syria? Will the U.S. withdraw all of its proxy fighters? Will Saudi Arabia do so? Will Russia do so? And will Bashar al-Assad be permitted to stay in power in Damascus? Well, there are a lot of questions, and we don't have many answers. One thing we can kind of predict is that Rexon Tillerson probably won't be Secretary of State when all this is hashed out. We heard yesterday he dodged the question of whether he had called Trump a moron, but he pushed back against the NBC report saying he has never considered resigning. And today, the New York Times published his political obituary, written by Peter Baker from the Washington Bureau. He said that the relationship between Trump and Tillerson has grown so acidic that Tillerson felt compelled to call that news conference yesterday to deny that he was thinking of resigning, a move that paradoxically only increased speculation that he might, in fact, resign of his own free will or not. Meanwhile, in the Middle East, we're learning that two Americans have been killed in Syria. These are Americans who volunteered to fight against the Islamic State. Some saw media accounts of Orlando or San Bernardino and traveled there, including a man named Robert Grote, who is a former Occupy Wall Street activist from Santa Cruz, California, just about 80 miles south of where I am. Also, another American, Nicholas Warden, from Buffalo, New York, age 29, had been injured in an attack and died later from his injuries. Both of these Americans were reported killed alongside a British man named Luke Rudder. Also, three U.S. Green Berets died on patrol near the borders of Mali and Niger. And they were there to act as consultants to Nigerian forces who are trying to crack down on a rebel group called Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. So we've had five Americans killed in conflict just in the past few days. Spain's constitutional court today has suspended a session of the Catalan regional parliament that's scheduled for next week. Now, there are two steps that appear to remain on the plan of the Catalonians to secede, to declare their independence. One is to certify the referendum that was held on Sunday, and the other would be to declare independence. Now, as of this moment, I haven't seen any indication that the certification of the election has taken place. So the suspension of the regional parliament may impact that as well. And the separatists say that they're entitled to an independent state because of the region's distinct language and culture. They say the referendum lent further legitimacy to their claim. Now, less than half of the eligible voters went to the polls, but many of them were told not to by the police force that's loyal to Madrid. So this puts us into uncharted territory. It leads to the potential for the invocation of a section of the Spanish Constitution that allows the Madrid government emergency powers to take full administrative control of a region like Catalonia. But boy, if they send in the army, I predict a bloody outcome. I don't know that the people of Catalonia, are ready to take up arms. But I think that there will be a continued nonviolent resistance, and we've seen that there's little restraint on the part of the police officers loyal to Madrid. Jeffrey Beauregard, Jim Crow Sessions III, who acts as Attorney General, has announced the Trump administration will no longer protect transgender Americans from discrimination. And this clarification also applies to gay Americans very broadly. This is under Title VII. He says Title VII's prohibition on sex discrimination encompasses discrimination between men and women, but does not encompass discrimination based on gender identity per se, including transgender status. Now, while we're talking about sex discrimination, there's a whole wave of reporting today about sexual harassment and abuse, starting with a big story in the New York Times that exposes the Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein as a serial, aggressive sexual predator. And we now know that one of his targets was the actress Ashley Judd, who was invited to his hotel room at the Peninsula Beverly Hills. He opened the door in his bathrobe and asked if he could give her a massage. And there's one case after another that is listed in this article. And one of the people on staff at the Weinstein Companies, Lauren O'Connor, 2 years ago, wrote a memo to the staff essentially exposing this rogue behavior by her boss. But it took the New York Times investigation and the discovery of previously undisclosed allegations that were settled with financial deals and gag orders that really paint this guy as the new Bill Cosby, I guess, without the date rape drugs. And Weinstein, he issued a bizarre apology that doesn't name any of the individuals that he harmed, says that he's trying to do better, but he knows he's got a long way to go. He's taking some time off from the movie business to spend more time with his family. Where have we heard that before? He quotes Jay-Z, and then here's where he goes. I'm going to need a place to channel my anger, so I've decided that I'm going to give the NRA my full attention. I hope Wayne LaPierre, he's the head of the NRA, will enjoy his retirement party. I'm going to do it at the same place I had my bar mitzvah. I'm making a movie about our president. Perhaps we can make it a joint retirement party. 1 year ago, I began organizing a $5 million foundation to give scholarships to women directors at USC. So this is a bizarre way of apologizing for what appear to be a series of sex crimes based on using his leverage and power as the guy who owns the casting couch. We're also learning from Britain Today that the former Prime Minister Ed Heath, who died in 2005, we now know that more than 40 people have made 42 separate allegations running from 1956 to 1992. The allegations include child sex abuse, physical abuse, sex abuse against an adult, and cases appear to be primarily reflecting boys who were aged 10 to 15 at the time, and sexual assaults on two adult men, one in 1976, the other in 1992. And then we have the case of Tim Murphy, which I was planning to ignore. He's just another horny, hypocritic Republican, a congressman from Pennsylvania. And yesterday it was disclosed that a mistress of his, whose name is, she's a psychologist, Shannon Edwards, she has outed him because she had an affair with him, and while they were copulating, at some point she was afraid that she had gotten pregnant. So she told the congressman, and he advised her to have an abortion. And the hypocrisy really bothered her, so she sent him some text messages that had become public. And he said, oh, don't pay any attention to that. My staff writes that stuff, and, you know, I just read it. But yesterday, he compounded his hypocrisy by joining House Republicans in passing a bill that would ban an abortion after 20 weeks of pregnancy. He was one of 237 votes for that piece of shit. And he also is a member of the bipartisan Congressional Pro-Life Caucus, and a co-sponsor of this bill, which is wrongly called the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. And regarding that bill, I have linked to a powerful, blistering op-ed from Jessica Valenti in today's Guardian. She said the purpose of this bill is to challenge Roe versus Wade. It is obviously unconstitutional under the current precedents, and the bill also includes criminal fines and penalties. It's not clear whether they apply to the abortion provider or the woman who receives the abortion. And Orwellian language came from the Majority Leader, Kevin McCarthy. He said the goal of the bill is ending suffering and helping people live. And Valenti kicks his ass on that. She says, that's an ironic sentiment just 3 days after Republicans let a health program expire that could leave millions of children without insurance, and 2 days after a massacre in Las Vegas that the GOP insists has nothing to do with the shocking availability of guns. The truth is that this bill, like all anti-abortion legislation, is not about helping people, never has been. It's a blatant attempt to challenge Roe v. Wade and to end all abortions, despite the human suffering such a ban would cause. Thanks for listening to my news and comment podcast today, all the way to the end here. You can find this podcast on YouTube. Share that information with your friends. I remain Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.